John Kettner is a professor of archaeology for the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico. In February, he spoke on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Stigler Lecture Series. I spoke with him while he was here. His talk, Chaco Canyon, From the Outside Looking In, focuses on an area in northwestern New Mexico, what we call the Four Corners, where Colorado, Arizona, Utah, and New Mexico meet. It's a canyon, but it is also an area of ruins. In the center of Chaco Canyon, there is a mass of monumental architecture from 1,000 years ago. Dr. Kettner says that what is so amazing about Chaco Canyon is that this location is literally in the middle of nowhere, a very arid environment, cold, windy, and little water. He looks at why and how, over 1,000 years ago, this monumental center rose in the middle of the desert. I began by asking him what he means by from the outside looking in.
The general consensus about Chaco Canyon is that it was a ceremonial center, perhaps a pilgrimage center, and people came from many, many miles around and brought things like corn and timbers and pots. They even imported things like chocolate and macaws from Mesoamerica, copper bells, turquoise, anything that was of value from many, many miles around came into the canyon. And so when we say from the outside looking in, not only is it us looking at it today, but it's also thinking about how people back then who were living in small farming villages scattered all over the area, what is it about the canyon that they found so compelling that they were interested in bringing in their best resources into this really desolate area? So,
and then it was sort of a trading post, or?
Yeah, although what we now understand about the canyon is that all this stuff went into the canyon and nothing ever came out. So it wasn't so much a trading post, but it was a consumer, an ultimate consumer. We can find, if we take a look, for example, at the trash piles that are in the canyon, you can see huge deposits of things like broken pottery and the remains of huge feasts and the like that were deposited there. So everything was coming into the canyon and it was staying there. So it wasn't really being traded out.
It was being used for, I think you mentioned that they were having the kind of ceremonies
right.
and things. Right.
Exactly. So okay. They had probably these events, ceremonial events that were likely tied to celestial phenomena such as solstices and equinoxes. Farming societies all around the world pay close attention to what's happening in the sky because it helps to guide them in their farming activities. And it's likely that during these major events, people came in from dozens and dozens of miles around, and they brought in food and offerings to the ceremonial center, and then as part of that, they would have these large feasts, various other kinds of events that they would all partake in.
Well, so you mentioned that, people that were scattered about, farmers and whatnot, kept coming into the center. Who built this center? Who was organizing it?
That's a great question. That's one of the that's one of those questions which has been debated quite a bit. One of the more popular theories over the years is that there were these very powerful leaders, perhaps powerful priests, that resided in the center, and they helped to guide what happened there. And one idea is that people who came in on these pilgrimages, part of fulfilling their ceremonial obligations would have been actually contributing their labor as well as their resources towards the center. So people would come in. One important note about the canyon is there are no trees in the canyon, but there's all these buildings. So all the timbers, it's estimated that perhaps 200,000 timbers had to be hand-carried across the desert. There were no beasts of burden. And so people are bringing in these timbers to roof the buildings and then perhaps contributing their labor to building the masonry work, to plastering the buildings, to repairing the buildings, as well as any other numbers of things. So that's one thought, is that there was these very powerful priestly leaders that were in charge and were giving instructions about
for kind of a higher purpose.
Right, exactly. Yeah. The idea there is that people felt compelled to contribute their labor and resources because they thought perhaps that would help them in their farming success. So that's one idea about the canyon. The other is that this was a purely cooperative endeavor, something which is sort of interesting to think about in our day and age, and that people actually, without the presence of leaders, came together and cooperated in the construction of the center because they felt that it was towards a higher good, towards a common good that would benefit them all, and that there wasn't a strong coordinated leadership.
Earlier on, you mentioned, for astrological purposes, I guess. And when I was looking at it, when I was looking up information about it, I saw that it was kind of built, you know, maybe with the sun in mind.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, that's one of the more impressive aspects of Chaco Canyon is that certainly as time went on, and it lasted, you know, perhaps a few generations at its height. But during that height, which took place in the 11th century A.D., the entire landscape within the canyon was constructed in order to align with various important directions and solar phenomena. So, for example, a lot of the buildings are oriented in cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. Most of the buildings seem also to have had built within them these features for observing important solar phenomena like the solstices and the equinoxes. So, for example, you might have during an equinox, the sun pass through a window and hit a niche in the opposite wall from the window, and it only happens on that day. And then there's the famous what's called the sun dagger, which is this really well-known and very impressive feature that was built on top of a mesa in the canyon. And it's an alignment of stones that are arranged in such a way that the light will pass through them, hit rock art on the wall opposite of them, and according to where the dagger of light falls as it passes through those rocks, it actually is predicting which equinox or which solstice is actually taking place. This would have been an amazing feature to produce because it's actually one feature that's predicting multiple kinds of solar phenomenon. So that's something which would have been very difficult for societies anywhere to have been able to do.
Well, that's why I was going to ask, how did they do this? I mean, because they didn't have really, you know, I mean, the tools and, I mean...
Sure, yeah, it's very impressive. And there's even some suspicion that same solar marker, this so-called sun dagger, may have also been used to predict lunar phenomena. So that's even more difficult to have all that coordinated in mm-hmm. one single observation point.
Have you had to study astronomy
a little bit
as an archaeologist?
Yes, yes, the beauty of archaeology is that you get to dabble in lots of things, yeah. and certainly astronomy is one of those. So
I guess I get to dabble in a lot of things too, it's like archaeology, and then this afternoon I'm interviewing somebody about art, and which is similar,
great.
I guess actually.
Yeah, absolutely.
Archaeology,
it's fun,
similar. Yeah, one of my questions was, you know, well, what happened to these people?
Yeah, so this phenomenon, as I've described it, because we don't exactly know how to characterize it, so we use the word phenomenon a lot to refer to Chaco. Its height is around the late 1050s AD, and by the early 1100s, the canyon is essentially empty. People have no longer, they're no longer doing their pilgrimages to the center, and although over the ensuing centuries, people continue to pass through the canyon, they no longer use it as such an impressive place. But people continue to exist in the larger Southwest, so the folks who had lived in Chaco Canyon, they moved elsewhere.
Where else do your studies take you?
That's a good question. I've recently been doing some work in collaboration with some archaeologists who do their excavations in Peru. There is, on the south coast of Peru, a center known as Cahuachi, and most people are familiar with it because the folks that lived at Cahuachi built the Nazca Lines, and the Nazca Lines are sort of those famous lines that can be observed from the sky, and there's a lot of shapes of like hummingbird shapes, and there's a monkey shape, and for a while people proposed that perhaps even aliens had been responsible for creating these lines. So it's the Nazca lines are known to a lot of people. What's interesting about comparing Kawachi with Chaco Canyon is that they're both these major pilgrimage centers. They both built these alignments in the ground. So in Chaco Canyon, as I mentioned, they built these long roadways. Mm-hmm. And in Kawachi, they built the Nazca Lines. People came to both Kawachi and Chaco Canyon from many miles around.
Is this around the same time period also?
So actually, Kawachi's quite a bit earlier.
Okay.
But it's a very similar phenomenon. So my colleague who's at Purdue University, Kevin Vaughn, and I have been looking at these two centers and trying to figure out if by comparing Chaco and Kawachi, we can get a better understanding of how these kinds of pilgrimage centers or religious centers emerge in the first place.
Well, so Chaco Canyon is now a national park, nationally protected place.
Right.
How does one go about preserving what is there?
Well, that's always a challenge in the Southwest as well as in the south coast of Peru or most parts of the world. There's a pretty illegal and rich trade in antiquities, and because so many of these sites are in desolate areas, it makes them easy targets for what we call pot hunters, people who are excavating these sites and digging them up and taking materials out illegally. In the case of Chaco Canyon, that core area of the canyon is preserved by the National Park Service, and of course they closely monitor who gets access to it and all that. But outside of the protected area are dozens and dozens and dozens of sites, and those are not so well protected. That's a big concern as an archaeologist, because the destruction of those sites through illegal excavation means that when I'm trying to answer questions about what happened in this region, my ability to answer those questions is compromised by the destruction of these sites. So, for example, I've been working for a number of years a distance south of Chaco Canyon in one of the farming villages from whence the pilgrims came, and most of the households in the prehistoric community I've been working on were destroyed, have been badly damaged by people who were digging for pots. And a lot of these are folks that, you know, their families had always dug these sites up, and it was something that they did and didn't really think twice about, because it seemed like there's so many of these sites around. But it's a major issue for archaeologists, because, as we say, if every single person who visited this area
took something,
then there'd be nothing left. So
why is it important to keep them? You know, why is it important for you to study them? Why is it important to keep them?
Sure, that's a great question. Well, for example, we know that again in the mid 1000s. Chaco Canyon was this huge center, a thriving center, thousands of people that were coming in and, again, importing things like chocolate all the way from what is now Mexico, or live macaws that they were trying to raise and bring in. You know, by any standard at that time, it seemed like there was no way that Chaco Canyon was ever going to end. But it did, and it ended, in some accounts, somewhat badly. In fact, the Pueblo people today still have stories about the demise of a place that probably is Chaco Canyon in their oral histories, and it was a pretty ugly end, a lot of violence. And
so what was this bubbling, vibrant place?
Right, so it ended, and so I think, you know, us today, it's useful and arguably very important to understand how these kinds of sort of pinnacles of a civilization, how it is that they end up falling apart. And in that case, it's probably a combination of the social and political structure that they had built up in the face of environmental change that challenged the ability of their social and political structure to contend with it. And I think these are lessons that are important for us to know today, because, of course, we are sort of at a pinnacle of
right.
our civilization. And we know that there are climate changes taking place, whatever caused by, but we know that they're challenging us. And I think archaeologists can look back at all these societies that once thrived and then fell apart and use those lessons to contend with what we're facing today or in the future.
Have you always been interested in history and archaeology?
No, actually, I started out as an environmental biologist, and then I took an anthropology class and fell in love with it, and never really looked back. I still love environmental biology as well. A lot of my my work in archaeology is informed by mm-hmm. by those disciplines. And I have a real passion for archaeology. It's just, it can teach us so much about how humans behave on all, so many different levels.
Dr. James Kettner is a professor of archaeology at the School for Advanced Research in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He gave a talk, Chaco Canyon, From the Outside Looking in February on the University of Arkansas campus as part of the Stigler Lecture Series. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.